Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
More than a quarter of female military veterans say they've been sexually assaulted while serving in the armed forces. And with 200,000 women serving in the military, that's a large enough problem to attract the attention of Congress.
Mr. Dominguez, this is an oversight hearing. An oversight hearing on sexual assault in the military.
That's John Tierney speaking to Michael Dominguez from the Department of Defense. The Oversight Committee asked to see the head of the Pentagon's sexual assault unit. Dominguez refused to allow her to testify, and that ticked off Congressman Henry Waxman.
What is it you're trying to hide? Mr. Chairman, the Department of Defense has a history of covering up sexual offense problems. And I don't know what you're trying to cover up here, but we're not going to allow it.
The rate of sexual assault in the military is much higher than it is in the general population. You can't hide from that. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 18th. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry this week. And the takeaway for me, Todd, is really there is always going to be some tense moments when the Congress tries to intervene with the military's handling of their own soldiers.
No doubt about it, especially in a time of war. The military does not want to be messed with during that time, but they may not have a choice in this case. Let's get right to some of the top stories we're following this morning. We're learning this morning of potential health care premium spikes in several states across the country. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says some insurance companies plan to raise their premium rates anywhere up to 56%. Earlier on The Takeaway this morning, Robert Zirkelbach, a spokesman for Washington's leading lobbying group for the health insurance industry, told us the price hikes are justified.
But what's driving those increases are really two main factors. The first is that underlying medical costs are increasing rapidly, and that accounts for about half of the increase.
But John Brown, vice president of a furniture company in Oklahoma, told us,
"We're the victims here. We can't do anything but pay their premium."
President Obama is expected to seize on these planned increases to reinforce his case for health overhaul.
8 of the 10 American missionaries arrested in Haiti are in Miami this morning. They were freed yesterday by a Haitian judge. And it was the best day ever for the Americans at the Winter Olympics. 6 medals, 3 of them gold. Lindsey Vonn shook off her shin injury to win the women's downhill. Shaun White picked up snowboard gold again. And Shawnee Davis took home his second straight gold in the 1,000-meter speed skating event.
"It's my moment. It's my party. I can, you know, like the girl says, she can cry if she wants to. I can party if I want to. It's my party. I can celebrate. I can dance. I can do whatever I want. I earned it."
The U.S. now has 14 medals. Next in line is Germany with 10. And as we talked about a few moments ago, sexual assault continues to be an issue in the military. Female service members are on Capitol Hill this month testifying before Congress about this. Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez joins us now. She's the highest ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee. Welcome to the program, Congresswoman. I'm wondering if you think that recruiting methods have contributed to this problem.
I think when we look at recruiting, we have to figure out if there is some way in which we can see that propensity. Now, one of the problems, as you know, that we've had in recent years when we were competing for people, when we needed more people to come into our military because many did not want to come because we are in 2 full-blown wars, is that, you know, recruiters would do almost anything to get somebody in, and they weren't looking, they weren't even looking at the fact that some of these people may have been alleged rapists. So we need to do a better job of what we're doing when we're recruiting also.
Congresswoman Sanchez, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are mixed and European markets are up. Futures mixed. The Dow will start at 10,309, the S&P at 1,099, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,226.
We'll be talking this morning about some programs that are designed to help kids graduate early so they can go to college. Now, what do you think? You were in high school for too long, and what do you think about work life or college for a 15-year-old? What about some of the 11th graders that you know? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE. Send your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And coming up, we'll talk more about women in the military with Representative Loretta Sanchez from California. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
Female service members have been testifying this month before Congress on the subject of sexual assault in the military. More than a quarter of women say they've been sexually assaulted or raped while they were serving. We're back now with Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. She sits on the House Armed Services Committee and represents the Anaheim area in California. Welcome again to the program, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
Representative, I wanted to start the interview by playing a clip from your colleague, Representative Jane Harman. And she's talking about a number of very striking cases of rape in the armed services.
A female military recruit is pinned down at knife point and raped repeatedly in her barracks. During a routine gynecological exam, a female soldier is attacked and raped by her military physician. Yet another young soldier, still adapting to life in a war zone, is raped by her commanding officer. Afraid for her standing in her unit, she feels she has nowhere to turn.
Representative Sanchez, are these typical stories that you're hearing as you look into this issue?
Well, those are not the typical stories, although we've heard of plenty of doctors who hit on or sexually harass or in some cases rape our military women. The more common issue is a lot of harassment. And in particular, in deployments overseas, our military women being raped by our military men quite a bit, usually in the evening. You know, we have a policy, and we've had for several years now, that women must go in the buddy system to the restroom. Most women will not go to the restroom at night because that's when most of the attacks are happening, for example, in the combat arena.
They're being attacked by their fellow soldiers and sometimes even their officers of higher rank. And that's a sad comment on the state of our military when they have to go to the bathroom with a buddy because they can't feel safe.
Not only do they have to go with a buddy, they're commanded to. In other words, the commanders know, they know that these women are being raped. And by the way, once you're identified as someone to have been raped, word gets around, and then you're raped more often. And so you just have a really tough time coming back into the unit. Most times you're discharged, or if you decide to go through the prosecution process, it's very difficult. We just had a hearing where there was an alleged rape. And then the next category was, okay, what was the dispensation? What happened? And then it would say the guy committed rape. And then the next thing was, okay, what happened to this person? And it says, oh, this person was demoted, or this person was sent to another unit. I mean, that's ridiculous. We need to prosecute these people and put them behind bars.
The BBC is actually working on a series that focuses on women in the military, and they spoke to one woman who served in the Air Force in 2006, and she herself was assaulted. Here's what she had to say.
You're supposed to carry your weapon at all times when you're in a combat zone. And I put my weapon down and walked away to go smoke a cigarette. And that's when I was attacked. I felt like if I had kept my weapon, maybe I would have been able to do something. Maybe I would have been able to prevent it. No punitive actions were taken against him. It would be my word against his.
So, Representative Sanchez, when you speak with military personnel about this issue and you hear stories like that, what do they say when they hear a soldier saying, I wish I'd had my weapon with me?
It's ridiculous. Most women out there understand that if they get raped, there's going to be almost a 0% chance that this is going to be handled correctly. There are three pieces to this whole issue of rape. The first is the culture. This should be a zero tolerance. There should be no rape going on by our military men to our military women. The second thing, we need to have the laws that actually go after these guys and allow them to be prosecuted. About 4 or 5 years ago now, I changed the laws to reflect the laws that we have for civilians in the United States. Why aren't they using them, and what do we need to fix to get this done? And the third thing is how a woman's treated when she's been raped. Is she going to be backed up in the system? Are people going to believe her? Is she going to be treated the way she should be instead of like this young lady said, I put down my weapon to go smoke a cigarette. I got raped. I couldn't go and tell people I got raped because then they were going to give me demerits and they were going to get me out of the military because I wasn't supposed to put down my weapon. Can you imagine that? You get raped and you can't go and tell somebody about it because you're afraid that person is going to tell you, oh, I got to get you out of the military because you were never supposed to put down your weapon.
I'm wondering how, if you feel like the rate of assault in the military reflects the rate that's in larger society. The BBC spoke with Dr. Kay Whitley. She's the director of the Pentagon's Sexual Assault and Prevention Response Office that was set up in 2005. And this is what she had to say.
Sexual assault is a national problem in the United States. It's not just in the military. In fact, we're told it's one of our nation's most underreported violent crimes. So since we recruit from the society we serve, we believe it's also a problem in the military.
What's your response to that?
I don't know if it's more in the military or less in the military than the civilian forces. I do know that rape goes on throughout our nation, that it's an incredibly ugly psychological attack on a woman. So I wouldn't tolerate it in either the civilian or the military.
My last question for you, Representative Sanchez, you are the highest ranking female on the House Armed Services Committee. Do you feel like there's an understanding with your colleagues in Congress over the seriousness of this issue and the urgency for getting it fixed?
As you know, our Congress is 83% male. There are certainly plenty of men now who have a good understanding, seeing their granddaughters and their daughters, that they would not want this to happen to them. And so there's more of an understanding going on. Of course, the women have always understood this to a large extent. The problem exists when people say, well, men will be men and women shouldn't be in the military. And what do you expect when we make a killer machine? And they've got aggressions and they've got to get those out. And I've actually heard these types of comments from some of my colleagues. That behavior and that thinking is unacceptable. And that's one of the things we have to change in the Congress also.
And that is Representative Loretta Sanchez. She represents California's 47th District. She is, as I said, the highest ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee. Thank you so much for joining us. I don't know. Did you hear the end of what she said?
I did.
I mean, there's some of our serving congressmen think that boys will be boys. I'm stunned by that.
I'm stunned by it, too. There are, the Congress, as people say, is a reflection of society also, and there are a lot of minds yet to be changed in Congress, just like across the rest of the country.
I still can't help but be shocked by it. And for more on the topic we're just talking about, sexual assault in the military, you can go to our website. There's a blog posting there by Marty Ribeiro. She was the young lady that we heard speaking in that interview. She served in the Air Force and was deployed to Afghanistan in 2006, where she was raped. You can read her chronicle of her experience at thetakeaway.org. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the top headlines.
There may be some big increases in health care premiums coming to several states across the country. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says some insurance companies on the individual insurance market intend to increase their rates by half. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Robert Zirkelback, a leading lobbyist for the insurance industry, a spokesman for a lobbying group in the insurance industry. He said these spikes are not about industry profits.
To put these numbers in perspective, for every dollar that our nation spends on health care, less than one penny goes towards health plan profits.
In Washington, the White House is expected to use the planned increases in premiums to reinforce its case for health reform.
In Vancouver yesterday was the best day ever for Americans at the Winter Olympics. They took 6 medals. 3 of them were gold. Snowboarder Sean Wright took home another gold, and with his signature double McTwist 1260, that's a 3.5
spins. I had that for lunch yesterday.
in the air. And also Shawnee Davis took home the gold for speed skating, and Lindsey Vonn in skiing. Also in sports news, Tiger Woods expected to speak publicly for the first time. He's going to talk tomorrow about his sex scandal that broke on Thanksgiving. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, a new report gives 8 states an F on managing their citizens' pensions. We're going to talk to you about whether or not your state is one of them.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts now on stories we're following this week. And let's go first to pensions. Pensions took a big hit in the recent financial crisis. There's probably many of you this morning who are listening who are worried about the shape that your pension is in. Well, there's a new report from the Pew Center. It says there are 8 states who've been given an F on their management of state pensions. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner in the New York Times. She's been following this story. Louise, what are these 8 states who are actually failing?
Good morning, Celeste. The states are Alaska, Colorado, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Maryland, New Jersey, Oklahoma, and New Jersey has not put money in its pension for 10 years.
Holy cow. Now, what does it mean when they're failing? Does that mean there's just a too large of a gap between what the benefits they're supposed to pay and how much money they have?
So the Pew Center looked at a number of factors. Remember, these are public state workers we're talking about here. And they looked at how much money the state had put aside and how much money it has promised. And these states all had at least a 20% gap on that. You know, they had put less than 80 cents aside for every dollar they had promised. Now, the other thing to keep in mind, you mentioned how the market had fallen. These numbers do not even include the market crash of the fall of 2008. This is using data before then. So the real picture would be significantly worse than this. It adds up across the 50 states to a $1 trillion gap between what our states have promised to pay public workers over the next 30 years and what they've put aside. It's a very big problem.
This is only affecting public workers. Do we have any idea of the pensions in, say, corporate or private corporations?
Right, so companies are required by law to put money in their pension each year, but states and local governments are not. They get non-binding recommendations what to put in, and this might be something that will be addressed given this problem. So companies are in better shape.
Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
All right, let's check in Vancouver. It was the best day for Americans ever at the Winter Olympics with 6 medals, including 3 gold yesterday. Lindsey Vonn started the week with a shin injury, and she's now at this point.
It's amazing. I mean, I've given up everything for this, and it means everything to me. It's why I work hard. It's why I'm in the gym, and, you know, my family's here supporting me, and it's just, it's awesome.
That's Lindsey Vonn at the bottom of the hill after her victory yesterday in the women's downhill. We're joined by Nathaniel Vinton. He's a sports writer for the Daily News. He's covered ski racing in Europe for years for publications like Ski Racing Magazine. Nathaniel, Lindsey Vonn, her bruised shin was the most publicized injury at the Olympic Games, and people were asking at the beginning of the week whether she would even be able to compete.
That's right, and it turned out that she was able to win the race by quite a big margin.
She crushed him.
Yeah, she did, and it was a really rugged course. It was icy and bumpy, and it had this nonstop terrain the whole way, so it put a lot of stress on that injury.
And she's got another couple of events coming up. There's the combined, there's the Super G. Does this victory in the downhill portend good things for those events? Is she as strong in those other two skiing events?
She is, traditionally. We've crammed the schedule pretty tight over the next couple of days with these events, and that's because the weather was bad for a while there. So whatever aggravation she caused with her race run, we'll find out how much that holds her back in those events. But yes, she's very good at Super Combined and Super G, which are both coming right up.
Right. Now, the women's downhill wasn't just about Lindsey Vonn. Let's talk briefly about Julia Mancuso, took home the silver for the United States.
Yep, that's right. Now, the two of them have been racing together, competing together since they were 12 years old or so. They have very different style personally and on their skis. And Julia Mancuso is by no means a dark horse, but this was her best race of the year, and she really rose to the occasion.
Let's also point out that over at the speed skating track, United States speed skater Shani Davis took home the gold in the men's 1,000. It's quite amazing. Nathaniel Vinton of Daily News, thanks for joining us. For more on our Olympics coverage, go to our website where we have stories from a team of bloggers. Skating blogger Aaron Harris has a post on who to look out for in tonight's free skate. That's at thetakeaway.org.
And our last takeout comes from our listeners. We talked yesterday about some of those crazy ice skating outfits sometimes you see. And we got this email from Jim in Fort Hill, South Carolina. He says, I saw a report on NBC where Brian Williams referenced the image of frilly, flamboyant, and sequins fashion for the male figure skating sport in a very derisive tone. Then during the story with figure skater Evan Lysacek, they went out of the way to mention how big, manly, and macho he is. I tell you what, Evan had an outfit on last month with straps in his shoulder and chest area that looked like something out of a leather bar. What's up with the attack on fashion? So what if we love each bauble and bangle? If you love it, Jim, I think that's great. Keep sharing with us at thetakeaway.org. You can post your thoughts on anything.
Now, on our site, a few of you have been reacting to our coverage of the administration's funding of the country's first nuclear plant in 3 decades. Someone called Reindeer Girl posts, "The idea of reprocessing spent fuel has been around for such a long time, and it's still a bad idea. First of all, it's incredibly expensive. In a struggling economy like ours, the last thing we need to do is spend the billions it will cost to rev up a reprocessing plant."
And we're wondering what your take is. Do you think nuclear reprocessing is the wrong way to go? Or anything that you have to comment on, we always welcome your thoughts at 8778-MYTAKE. You can post on thetakeaway.org. Don't forget, tomorrow's Friday. We're going to be talking about who had a good week and who had a bad week, and we had a sad nomination.
I'm Veronica from Oklahoma City, and I nominate my husband for the worst week. He's been unemployed since July and was working towards a job that he really wanted and did not get it after 4 months of process. I vote my husband.
That's bad news. I am very sorry to hear that, Veronica, and for you and your husband. But we take your suggestions for whomever had a bad week or a good week. Don't give up. Give us your suggestions at 8778-MYTAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Listen in on Friday. We're going to see how they compare to the winners and losers that were picked by our friends from The Week magazine. Coming up, our coverage on the stimulus package a year later continues. We're going to talk about a very ambitious program to revolutionize public transportation. Stay with us for that. Coming up, maybe one way we can grade the stimulus project is how many revolutionary public transportation projects did it fund. We're going to tell you about one more coming out of Kansas City in just a few moments. But first, here's the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. As the sound of children welcoming the Dalai Lama to Washington, the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader will meet with President Obama later this morning at the White House, despite strong protests from China. And more than a quarter of women serving in the armed forces say they've been sexually assaulted or raped while in service. Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, the highest-ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee, told us she's disturbed by comments she's heard in Congress about the issue of sexual abuse in the military.
Well, men will be men, and women shouldn't be in the military, and what do you expect when we make a killer machine? I've actually heard these types of comments from some of my colleagues.
You can hear that full interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. Female service members have been testifying this month before Congress on the issue.
Now in Afghanistan.
Javelin!
Fighting is intensifying in parts of the Afghan town of Marja this morning, where U.S. Marines have come under attack by insurgents with rocket-propelled grenades. This comes even though U.S. officials say the town may soon be safe enough for Afghan officials to begin setting up a city government. Also this morning, we're learning of the arrest of 2 Taliban officials. One of the arrests was reportedly a result of information gleaned from captured Taliban operations chief Mullah Abdul Baradar, and officials in Pakistan say up to 9 militants with links to al-Qaeda have been arrested. Here at home, former President Bill Clinton says the heart procedure he underwent last week has gotten him making some changes.
I intend to continue to work as hard as I can, but I am going to manage the stress better. Sleep more, fewer overnight flights, be more disciplined about taking some exercise every day.
Now, on top of that, former president may want to smile, though. Although he's a pretty smiley guy, researchers at Columbia University tracked the happiness levels of more than 1,700 adults and found that happier people were less likely to have heart attacks. Now, let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up, and futures are also mixed. The Dow gets underway this morning at 10,309. The S&P opens at 1,099, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,226. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Now we continue our ongoing national coverage of transportation and the government stimulus package. We're going to take you to Kansas City today, where there's an ambitious project that hopes to take federal stimulus dollars and then use them to revolutionize public transportation there. The federal money is coming from a program that's called TIGER. And it's funding 51 innovative transportation projects across the country. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced which communities would be getting Tiger funds yesterday. So joining us again is Takeaway transportation correspondent Andrea Bernstein. Andrea, what is Tiger?
TIGER stands for Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery. And, you know, remember back in the campaign when the president was sort of talking about all the new ways of governing and how money was going to be handed out based on merit? Well, you've got this, you know, big old stimulus package of $787 billion, and you've got this little bitty piece, $1.5 billion. But this $1.5 billion is actually upending the whole way transportation is funded in this country. Because what the administration did is it took applications and it handed them out based on merit. How much would it help economically distressed areas? How good would it be for the environment? And what it came up with is a pretty interesting package of transportation projects around the country. You've got a bus rapid transit, sort of state-of-the-art fast buses in Nevada and in Colorado. You've got a streetcar in Tucson, one in Dallas. You've got light rail in Detroit. You've got bike lanes in Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey. And the idea of all of these projects is that they're supposed to start to remake the way Americans get around.
I think maybe the federal government wasn't prepared for the huge amount of applications that came in. How many cities applied for this money?
They got actually $60 billion worth of applications from around the country. Many states applied several times over. They gave dozens of projects. So this was a huge, huge, huge response. And one of the things that they're hoping is that by sort of beginning to shift the way people think about transportation funding, that when they get to the giant transportation reauthorization bill, which is either going to come up this year or next, that people will begin to think, okay, we're not going to sort of hand out the way we always have based on congressional district, but we're going to hand out stuff based on a project's merit. And if you look at the whole stimulus and how the funding is being handed out, this is one area where you actually see that it's sort of doing the things that the administration promised with the stimulus, which is that it would not only get money out the door, put people to work, but also start to pave the way, if you will, for the future transportation network
right.
of the country.
Okay, well, let's go to one of the cities that actually won this contest for money, Kansas City, Missouri, and we're joined today by Rodney Knott. He's the president of Kansas City's historic Mannheim Park Association. Rodney, how much money did you get, and was it what you applied for?
Good morning. Well, the region received $50 million.
That's a lot of money. Is that how much you applied, asked for?
Yes. Basically, Kansas City is unique in that we sit on the border between Missouri and Kansas. So some of the projects are in Missouri and some are in Kansas.
Okay, so what are you doing with this $50 million?
Well, the $50 million on the Missouri side is going to go for, number one, what we call the Green Max bus line. And basically it's an express bus, but it's one that is more energy efficient. And we also are going to be using it for infrastructure.
Well, what are these neighborhoods like that are going to be served by this bus line?
Well, unfortunately, the neighborhoods that are being targeted have been historically underfunded. So they are primarily lower-income neighborhoods in the inner city.
And the bus line is going to help them? How is it going to help them? It's going to get them into work and jobs, or what is
it? Unfortunately, as our cities have developed, things have become more spread out. So transportation for lower-income folks tends to be a little bit more difficult because most of the jobs are not in the neighborhoods they live in. So transportation is invaluable to them not only finding work, but just being able to do daily things that many of us take for granted.
Andrea Bernstein, let's go back to you. What do you find about that's so interesting that's happening in Kansas City? That sounds like a relatively standard public transportation project.
Well, the Kansas City Green Zone, as it's known, has been held up as a national project because it's taken what's a really poor neighborhood and it's drawn down stimulus funds from all kinds of areas. So weatherization money to make houses more energy efficient and give people jobs, HUD money to help support the housing in the neighborhood, and now this bus line. And the theory behind these bus lines is that they increase the transit density in the inner city, which makes it possible for people to work there. And as one person told me when when I was reporting this story, people attract people, and that means economic development for these cities like Kansas City.
This is obviously a good thing for the cities that won, but there's so many cities that applied for funds that didn't get them. Is there controversy over who got picked?
I haven't heard any yet. Most people are just pretty happy that they got something. It was spread around the country, but I think people are really hoping to get more, and especially with these transit projects, what's happening is mayors do see them as economic development. They do see them as a way to attract businesses, and they want to get ready so when the next round of funding comes, they can get theirs.
That's Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's transportation correspondent. We also spoke with Rodney Knott, president of the Manheim Neighborhood Association in Kansas City, Missouri. We've got a podcast from Andrea. It's on thetakeaway.org. Looks at high-speed rail and other projects. And we ask if we'll remember these particular projects the way we do Depression-era public works projects. It's a good question, and it's part of the Transportation Nation podcast. You can find it at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, technology in service of senior citizens. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. What kind of a person would actually try to profit out of a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti? Well, a BBC investigation has uncovered evidence that criminal gangs have been cashing in on the Haiti earthquake by asking people to donate to bogus charities. They ask for donations, usually via untraceable bank transfers, and they say it's to pay for relief supplies, but they're pocketing the cash. The BBC's Razia Iqbal actually tracked down one gang that's based in Spain, and she joined us earlier from London to tell us more. Razia asked one of the managers of the supposed fund what they were using the money for, and this is what he said.
We are going for medical supplies, mostly the blankets, the bandages, and some drugs, mostly.
So Razia Iqbal, he was lying about all of that.
He absolutely was lying about all of that. I spoke to him on several separate occasions. Each time I would ask him what sorts of things they were going to be sending the money for, because what we tried to do was try and get them on side and try and persuade them to open up a little bit. In order for us to make a donation, we wanted to meet them. We wanted to give them a donation in person, which is what we set out to do at the outset. And he continued to tell us that they had particular projects, completely unsolicited. He sent us photographs via email to show us the kind of work that they were doing in Haiti, the supposed projects. One of the photographs turned out to be of a camp, which they said was in Haiti. But the camp, when we zoomed in on the picture, had a logo of a well-established British charity, SOS Children. We went to Cambridge in England to go and talk to the chief executive of this charity, and he said this is a complete cut and paste job from our website. They've taken a photograph from our website and sent it to you, pretending it's work that they're doing in Haiti. But astonishingly, the camp that they said they were setting up in Haiti was actually from the earthquake in Pakistan in 2005, and not even from Haiti at all.
Well, this clip is from your interview with the CEO of this legitimate charity, SOS Children. This is Andrew Cates.
Really, they're exploiting the victims. So I don't feel that they're robbing me. I feel that they're taking from the mouths of the children that we are trying to help. And that is something which is very difficult not to get angry about.
So once you discovered that this charity, the ME Foundation, was bogus, what did you do?
We then tried to arrange to meet with them in London. They kept putting us off and saying, because they said they had a headquarters in London. We went to the headquarters, an address in London. Turned out it was a news agent's, a shop that just sells newspapers, etc., sweets, that had been there for 20 years. So they just plucked an address in London out of the hat and put it on their emails when they were sending out these spam emails to people all over the world. We then arranged for a courier to send the donation that we were willing to give to this charity to Spain. And it turned out we ended up going to Spain in order to confront them. As soon as we confronted the man who came to pick up the package, he ran away.
He fled from your BBC team.
He did. He fled as soon as he saw us, took his jacket off, dropped his fake ID, which we now have, which we're going to hand over to the authorities in England, and dropped his flip-flops and ran. I've never seen anyone bolt quite so fast.
Razia Iqbal is a special correspondent for our partner, the BBC. She's been investigating bogus charities that are taking advantage of the disaster in Haiti to steal money, from generous donors. The BBC has contacted the supposed CEO of the foundation whose man ran from them in Spain. So far, they've gotten no response.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwilligan for John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, could a robot replace a caregiver? We talk tech every Thursday, and we'll look at developing technology designed to help seniors. More on that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The American military in Iraq has run a reconnaissance flight over Baghdad this morning. They're assessing the security situation in the city ahead of elections in March. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has been on this morning's flight. Earlier, I asked him what the point of the flight was.
Well, what they're trying to do is to ensure security when it comes to the March 7th elections. We went up in this small six-seater passenger airplane that's been fitted out with very high-tech surveillance equipment. They've got thermal imaging and infrared, so they can really zoom in close down onto the streets of Baghdad. We saw that on the screens there, get up right and close and check for any suspicious vehicles or anything that might be attempting to carry out a bombing or destabilize the elections. Now, this is a mission that's been carried out jointly by the Iraqi Air Force and US Navy pilots who've been training these Iraqi pilots to fly these missions. They fly them right across Iraq, and they say that in preparation for the elections, by the time it comes to March the 7th, the Iraqis will be doing this on their own.
That was Gabriel Gatehouse from our partner, the BBC, in Baghdad.
Staying abroad, Israel has been criticized by Britain over the use of fraudulent British passports by the suspected killers of a Hamas leader in Dubai last month. The assassins have been accused by Hamas of being Israeli agents. Writer and commentator Frederick Forsyth said most people believe the murder was carried out by the Israeli Secret Service, Mossad.
These assassinations, when they happen, are supposed to happen invisibly and inaudibly. They are not supposed to end up splashed over every headline on every newspaper in the world. They're not supposed to end up with the ambassador being summoned and asked what the hell he thinks his country is doing.
Israel denies any involvement in the killing this morning. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching.
All right, it's Thursday, and here on The Takeaway, Thursday means technology. Now, there's a stereotype that old folks and technology just don't mix. So senior citizens and robots, could they possibly get along? What we're talking about is new assistive technologies that might be designed to help seniors, not just make him mad or make him confused, not at all. But there's some controversy about this, and we're joined by Nick Tarafranca. He's medical director of Medisense Wireless, which is a spinoff of the UCLA Wireless Health Institute. He develops assisted technologies that increase elder independence and safety. We're also joined by Sherry Turkle. She researches robotics and their effects on people's lives. She's a professor at MIT and author of Simulation and Its Discontents. Dr. Tarafranca, right off the bat, we're all familiar with MedAlert badges and scooters. Those have been around, those are technologies that have been around a long time. What are some of the most exciting innovations that you see for assisting senior citizens?
The exciting innovations that are coming down the pipeline are devices that will help predict the degree of instability and risk of falling for individuals, as well as systems that will monitor medication compliance, and also to further assist people recovering from the effects of serious illness or injury, such as strokes.
A device to monitor balance and risk of falling, this would be something that would be worn on the person, something like a gyroscope?
The devices that are under development contain gyroscopes and accelerometers, and these people might have heard through science newscast that these are the same components that help guide missiles today, but these components are now incorporated into a insert that will be placed in the shoe, and also from the Wireless Health Institute, there's a cane that incorporates these components.
A cane that incorporates it. Sherry Turkle, I want to ask you, because a device that prevents falling down, a device that monitors medication compliance, those sound like great things. In my family, my uncle and my mom monitored my grandmother's medication compliance, and I think she was happy to have their assistance and their attention doing it. Is there a risk that these devices replace that kind of attention from kids?
I don't think the risk is from these simple devices. In other words, I think that what technology does is it gives us a chance to ask ourselves if they embody our human values. And I think our values for the elderly should be to both give them increasing autonomy and also increase their sense of connection with other people. And I think that there's always that balance of wanting to give them increasing autonomy, because that makes people feel good, and then also when they need the help, to bring in human connection. So these particular devices don't seem to me to raise red alerts of any sort. The kinds of devices that I have problems with are, for example, when you're making a decision about a kind of technology to turn an older person in bed. Do you go for something that's like a spatula on top and bottom that literally flips them, or do you have sort of robotic arms that you put your arms into, kind of hydraulic arms, that let the person keep the elderly person, let the daughter, for example, or son, keep the elderly person at home with them, and that they can turn with these assistive arms the person in the bed. In the one case, you're treating the person like a pancake. In the other case, you're increasing your sense of connection to them.
That's
how I see the kind of distinction.
Nick Terafranca from Medicens at UCLA. A lot of the technology that we do see that helps older folks, things like scooters, do improve independence and mobility, and at the same time might have the effect of just making it okay for children with elderly parents to think they're doing fine on their own and go about their own busy lives. Do you see any risk of that here?
Actually, I see a very large benefit to incorporate technology that was just spoken about. From a personal experience with my own parents, I know if you can keep the elderly in their own home environment with their own family, they have a better quality of life, in my opinion. So,
do you see any of the risk side of it at all, or do you think it's all benefit?
I don't see a significant risk that would harm the patient. No.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, one of the things that I was looking at was the stroke recovery video game?
Yes.
Can you tell me?
It's a Wii game. Is that a Wii game?
Well, I think you can sort of equate it to a Wii game. What this device is, it's called CMAS. It's a clinical movement assessment system. And what this is in simplistic form is it allows the patient to fully engage a monitor, if you would, and go through a series of exercises that play on a condition known as plasticity in neurophysiology, which basically is a condition that allows the brain to remember where it was previous to the injured state and helps it to repair itself and recover. Studies have shown that by engaging people in repetitive movement, they have a better outcome and faster recovery period following stroke.
Sherry Turkle from MIT, does this stroke assist game, if you will, I'll call it a game, does that fit the mold of what you think is a beneficial technology?
That sounds beneficial. Where I have problems, actually, are when is in a new trend where you give the elderly robotic dolls as companions.
There is a trend of that.
There is a trend of that.
Sounds troubling. What is that?
They're very big in Japan, and they're going to be now marketed here. And in this kind of, it's kind of a sociable robot. And the problem I have with that is there's a kind of offloading. These robots, of course, don't understand anything of what the elderly person is saying to them, and yet the elderly connect to them, often in the absence of other people to talk to.
Sherry Turkle is an MIT professor and author of Simulation and Its Discontents. Nick Terafranca joined us from UCLA. He's medical director of Medisans Wireless.
If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, we have a bevy of extras for you, such as about the Olympics. Skating blogger Aaron Harris is in Vancouver. He wrote a post about what to look for in tonight's women's free skate competition. Go to thetakeaway.org and click on blog. We also have something special for you dog lovers out there who sent us some photos, a slideshow commentary.
Here is a Chesapeake Bay Retriever looking probably the way we imagine we would look, contemplatively, contentedly.
I can't get enough of listening to her voice. That's Sarah Montague, reporter for our home station, WNYC. She took a look at 8 of our dog show contestants and gave her commentary. Take a listen at thetakeaway.org. And as always, we want your suggestions for who had a good week or a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. Give us your suggestions at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to find out who The Week thought, The Week magazine, who they thought had a good week or a bad week tomorrow.
Trump.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick, and for John Hockenberry, it's The Takeaway. Healthcare is taking up all of the oxygen in Washington and taking up about 17% of the economy. Barack Obama is trying to resuscitate his health reform bill, and the latest strategy is to turn it from a debate about medicine to a debate about price. This morning, the administration fires another barrage at insurance companies and their rising prices. What they don't know is whether the reaction to the latest outrage over price will sound like this, or like this. One final bid to get health reform passed on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 18th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week, and I'm here with Celeste Headlee. You know, Celeste, the takeaway for me is when health reform started, it was about reforming the health insurance system. It was about the economy. Then it was about getting everyone insured. Now it seems to be simply about your checkbook, about the price to try to get this passed.
Well, I think that behavioral economists, will tell you that people are much more likely to change their behaviors based on their checkbook than they are on morals. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning, though.
Stop fighting for Javelin!
Fighting is intensifying in parts of the Afghan town of Marja this morning, where U.S. Marines have come under attack by insurgents with rocket-propelled grenades. This comes even though U.S. officials say the town may soon be safe enough for Afghan officials to begin setting up a city government. Also this morning, we're learning of the arrest of two Taliban officials. One of the arrests was reportedly a result of information gleaned from captured Taliban operations chief Mullah Abdul Baradar, and officials in Pakistan say up to 9 militants with links to Al-Qaeda have been arrested. More than a quarter of women serving in the armed forces say they've been sexually assaulted or raped while in service. Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, the highest-ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee, told us she's disturbed by comments she's heard in Congress about the issue of sexual abuse in the military.
Well, men will be men, and women shouldn't be in the military. And what do you expect when we make a killer machine? I've actually heard these types of comments from some of my colleagues.
You can hear that entire interview on our website, thetakeaway.org.
We're learning this morning of potential health care premium spikes in several states across the country. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says some insurance companies plan to raise their premium rates as much as 60% for individual plans. President Barack Obama is expected to seize on these increases to reinforce his case for a health overhaul. We're joined now by John Brown. He's vice president of Brown Furniture Company. The Obama administration is now saying that this debate is all about price. But John, does it resonate with you in your furniture business? If the debate were all about price and your premiums, would they win you on board with health reform?
Absolutely. Pricing has been out of control for a long time. Control price, and you have my support.
Your support. What have happened to your premiums in the last, let's say, year or two?
Well, personally, my premium, I just got the letter this month. My premiums are going up about 11% this year, which is not out of the ordinary. Every year it goes up. Every 5 years it goes up about 30%. My employee last year, his insurance premium went up 28%. And then we had to, of course, play the insurance game where you apply and apply and wait and wait.
And those numbers are double or triple the multiples of national health inflation itself. John, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Best day ever for Americans at the Winter Olympics. 6 medals, 3 of them gold. Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up and futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,309, the S&P at 1,099, and the NASDAQ at 2,226.
Coming up, we go into space with astronaut Buzz Aldrin. It's been 80 years since Pluto was discovered, but that doesn't mean we should love it any less. Buzz Aldrin joins us later on this hour. We'll also be talking about some programs to help kids graduate early so they can go to college. Do you think you were in high school for too long, and would you have been ready for work life at age 15? What about some of the 11th graders you know? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE. You can post to the website at thetakeaway.org.
More on the outrage over health insurance prices going through the roof in a minute.
Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick is with me this morning. He's filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. In the continuing saga of healthcare reform in Washington, in our last episode, Anthem Blue Cross had raised its rates as much as 39% across the state of California. This caused emotional outrage on Capitol Hill. President Obama is very angry with Anthem Blue Cross. That's not the only people that he's angry with. Blue Cross in California is raising their rates by almost 40%. That's in spite of the fact that they reported huge earnings for last year. So, Todd, why did they need to raise their rates so much?
So you're right, Celeste. It is the next chapter in the health reform soap opera. And in this chapter, Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius is releasing a report this morning that critiques what the report calls a broken health insurance industry, solely focused now on the bottom line at health insurance companies. Now, we got a sneak peek at this report last night, and we've posted a copy of it on our website at thetakeaway.org. And here's some headlines from the announcement that the Secretary will be making later this morning. The bottom line, according to the administration, is that Anthem Blue Cross that you just mentioned in your chapter there is not alone. So here are some of the numbers. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Maine is trying to raise its premiums for people buying insurance on the individual market now by 23%.
That means not their business. Their company's not buying it for them.
Well, if it's a small business, it might be, but not a large employer. This is anyone under probably 15 employees. You might shop for it yourself. If you have 7 employees, you probably buy individual insurance for them, and it's always more expensive. And these are the people that health reform is supposed to be helping. So meanwhile, over in Michigan, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan requested a 56% hike in premiums for those same individual plans. Increases in other states include 20% at Regency Blue Cross Blue Shield in Oregon, up to 16% in Rhode Island, and as high as 40% for some plans in Washington State. This is all according to the Obama administration this morning. So, of course, this report does not come in a vacuum. Democrats, Celeste, as you know, they have a health reform effort in Washington that's stalled. And this report is sort of the latest attempt to refocus the debate and refocus it now directly on people's wallets and their checkbooks.
Well, you know, the question for me was, are these all justified? I mean, is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan losing money by the rate of 56%?
Well, they're not losing money, but they say that this isn't all about profit. We did get a chance to get some response from the insurance industry. The Takeaway spoke with Brad Flugel. He's executive vice president of WellPoint, the parent company of 14 Blue Cross Blue Shield plans across the country, including California's Anthem Blue Cross. Now, here's what Flugel had to say about the company's profits.
Our overall profit margin as a company is around 3 or 4%, which is much less than other sectors of the healthcare industry. So it's not really our profits that are driving these increases, nor is it our administration.
Now, Flugel says skyrocketing premiums are an inevitable consequence of the faltering economy, not just profit taking.
Unfortunately, with the economic issues that are going on, people are making decisions about whether to continue to stay with their individual health insurance policy. What we're finding is that those that tend to be of better health and younger are the ones who are first dropping their coverage, which means that the remaining people that are insured just have a higher average cost because you don't have the healthier folks that tend to use less services helping to balance out the risk pool.
Now, one of the people on the ground who's really being affected by this, we're joined again by John Brown. He's a small business owner from Oklahoma. He has a furniture business. You heard from him just a couple of minutes ago, who said that his premiums and his employees' premiums going up between 11 and, John Brown, I think you said 26%. Meanwhile, national health insurance inflation, I think, is around 6%. So you're really getting hit.
I think inflation rates are a lot lower than that. I think these increases are 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation, even at 10%. And last year, my employees' insurance went up 28%. Mine just went up 10% this year, which happens every year. Every 5 years, in 2007, my insurance went up 30% in a 15-month period. That's about 2% a month, which is about the rate of inflation for the year in 2007. This is not new. This is not something that's just happening this year. This happens every year.
Every year. And undoubtedly, I don't even need to ask you, undoubtedly hurts your ability to do business and certainly to support your employees. Well, John Brown, let me ask you, when you hear insurance executives or spokespeople say this isn't about profit, this is just, you know, they're victims of a bad economy like everyone else. Do you buy it?
I don't buy it because I have the proof. I have the documentation from every year since I was 25 years old. I've had the same insurance every year. I have the same letters. Like I said, in 2007, when I turned 40, and my wife turned 40, our insurance went up 30% on an individual policy. And 10% may not sound like a lot, but the bigger the premium, obviously, the more money 10% is. This year, my insurance will go up $720 this year. What does that buy? Well, it buys a lot of things.
Buys a lot of things. Well, to put it in some in a national perspective, I think healthcare spending this year is going to be something like $2.2 trillion. We had a brief chat with Robert Zirkelbeck. He's a spokesman for America's Health Insurance Plans. Now, they're the most powerful K Street lobbying firm for the health insurance industry. Listen to what he had to say about the industry and this amount of money that's changing hands.
To put these numbers in perspective, for every dollar that our nation spends on health care, less than one penny goes towards health plan profits.
John Brown, less than 1% goes towards health plan profits, he says. They say they're not gouging.
I can easily reduce my profits at Brown Furniture Company. I can just pay myself more money. The profit is not the fact. It's not the point. It's the efficiency of what they're running, how they're running this business. Somebody's making money, and it's certainly not me.
Now, what they say is that the overall cost of providing health care services is going up so fast that they have no choice but to raise prices. I guess that would be the equivalent of, in your furniture business, if the price of wood, the price of materials were somehow had a 10% inflation rate, you'd have no choice but to raise prices.
The problem is, people do not have to buy new furniture. People have to buy health insurance to protect their families.
Good point.
We're the victims here. We can't do anything but pay their premiums, because if we don't, then we have to go insurance shopping, run the risk of losing insurance. Everybody's got pre-existing conditions. How do you do it? How do you deal with it?
John Brown's a small business owner from Oklahoma. He owns his own furniture business. Health insurance premiums for his workers up as much as 28% in the last year, and I think as much as 30 or 35% over the last 5 years. This all amid a report from the Obama administration that individual insurance premiums are being hiked as much as 40% in individual states as the health reform debate heats up again in Washington. Now let's check in on some stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Claims for unemployment benefits rose sharply last week after a decline the previous week. The Labor Department said first-time claims increased by 31,000. And there are further reports this morning that the U.S. is winding down relief efforts in Haiti. U.S. Commander Lieutenant General Ken Keene says the U.S. hospital ship Comfort is emptying out.
We were able to locate places within Haiti, medical facilities, to place patients that have been treated initially on the Comfort to other locations.
Earlier this week, it was reported that the number of U.S. troops in Haiti has been scaled down. The head of Toyota now says he may consider appearing before a congressional committee looking into the company's safety recalls if he gets a personal invitation to appear. Meanwhile, the Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says his department is considering a fresh investigation into Toyota over problems with power steering in the Corolla model.
We will not sleep until every Toyota is safe for people to drive.
Today, Toyota is rolling out ads in U.S. newspapers to calm customer concerns about the ongoing safety issues.
In Vancouver, downhill skier Lindsey Vonn said winning the gold yesterday was incredible.
When I crossed the finish line, seeing my name up there, number one, was overwhelming. You know, it was the best feeling of my life, and I've been crying for a long time, and just seeing my family here was overwhelming.
U.S. also took gold in the men's snowboarding and men's speed skating. Staying with sports, Tiger Woods will speak publicly for the first time tomorrow since his sex scandal broke around Thanksgiving. Coming up, Haitian officials have released 8 of the 10 Americans accused of child trafficking. We talk more about the latest with a BBC correspondent. That's in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Some takeouts now on the stories we're following this week. 6 medals yesterday for the United States at the Winter Olympics, including 3 gold. This is what the takeaway control room this morning is calling best Olympics day ever. Here are some highlights. Lindsey Vonn shook off a shin injury. She won the gold medal in the women's downhill. The United States also took the silver in that. The halfpipe, snowboarding halfpipe, went to American Sean White. And sports writer Dan Friedel joining us from Vancouver. How about Shani Davis in the 1,000 speed skate?
Yeah, that was quite a performance. Shawnee Davis hasn't lost at that distance this year, so he was the odds-on favorite, and he came through. He was one of the last skaters to go in the competition, and it's the kind of competition where you get one shot. You know, there's no second chance, and he pulled it off. He had a great skate and added to the record haul for the day and a gold medal. And his teammate Chad Hedrick was up there on the leaderboard as well, and he got the bronze.
And we should also add that in the women's downhill, it wasn't just Lindsey Vonn who took the women's downhill. Julia Mancuso with the silver. So some big medal performances for the United States. And everyone now is looking forward to men's figure skating tonight. What are we looking out for?
Well, I mean, we'll be looking at the free skate, and that's the thing that's left up to the judges' interpretation. The skaters have a chance to show their artistry in a way that's not quite as evident in the short program. The free skate allows them to show off their interpretive ability a little bit more, and also their athleticism. You have to remember that they're out there on the ice skating for 3 or 4 minutes and doing these jumps, and they've got to land perfectly. And it's an athletic competition for sure. The favorite looks like it's going to be Russian Evgeny Plushenko.
Right.
And the hometown favorite, Patrick Chan, is going to have to put in a great skate for Canada to get himself into medal contention. And the American certainly can look out for Evan Lysacek, the defending world champion, and Johnny Weir for good performances. So it should be exciting. It'll definitely be something to watch.
Johnny Weir, always controversial. Looking forward to the skating tonight. Freelance sports writer Dan Friedel joining us from Vancouver.
And now from Haiti, we have news that 8 of the 10 missionaries, American missionaries, who were charged with possible kidnapping, taking Haitian children out of the country, have now been freed. 2 members of that group are still behind bars facing extra questioning. Rick Davis joins us now. He's the correspondent in Haiti for our partner, the BBC, and he's in Port-au-Prince. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Good morning.
So the eight of the missionaries have been released. What has been the response in Haiti?
Well, so far, mixed, because many people could understand the reasons why the parents initially gave the 33 children to the Americans. That, just go back in time, they were stopped nearly 3 weeks ago at the border with the Dominican Republic with a busload of children who they said they were trying to help. They said they were orphans, but they didn't have a proper documentation, and that's really the reason why this all came about. Now, the judge has been looking into this. They were charged with 2 counts, one of child abduction, child kidnapping, and one of criminal association. But yesterday, the judge decided that there was enough evidence, enough testimony from the parents that they'd willingly given their children up, that there was no criminal intent, and that's the reason why they left. That's the reason why the charges haven't been dropped, but that's the reason why they left the country. Many Haitians can understand the reasons why some parents would go to that sort of extreme and give their children away, especially in the aftermath of the earthquake.
And yet the judge has decided to keep 2 of them behind bars. Did he say why?
Carissa Coulter and Laura Silsby, the leader of the Idaho-based group. Yeah, because he needed a bit more information. He wanted to do some further questioning in terms of what they were doing in the country before the actual earthquake. Now, they say that they were visiting orphanages. He wants to find out exactly what they were doing and why they were doing that.
And give us an update on the relief efforts. We've been hearing that the U.S. is stepping down relief efforts in Haiti. Is the U.S. the only country doing that, or many countries?
Well, the situation is that there are many relief organizations who are on the ground here. Even before this disaster, this had the second highest number of NGOs. Much of the work, much of the relief operation is now in their hands. You're starting to see real movement, though. Some of the schools are starting to reopen. They've got these things called schools in a box, which UNICEF have, which are basically metal containers. You open them up and there's activities for children to actually get going in terms of their schoolwork. The government here really concerned that they don't want children to miss much of the school year. They really don't want to hamper their future. Education.
And how about the hospital system? Have they started to begin to rebuild some medical facilities?
It's too early for that. There are a number of hospital-tented hospitals which are all over the city. But you're starting to see some of the NGOs, some of these organizations, now moving away from Port-au-Prince and trying to focus their attentions on other areas which haven't really received the same amount of attention. Places like Leogan and Jacmel. More hospitals are opening up there. More NGOs are moving their work out to the regions, to the outskirts of the city, to try and help more people.
Nick Davis, we heard news from Haiti's president, René Préval, that there's so much rubble to be cleared away that they won't even be able to start rebuilding for at least a year. Do you see evidence of that?
everywhere you go. It's actually quite strange. I left Haiti for a few days just for some R&R, and I was surprised that I was looking around and couldn't see rubble. Everywhere you look in this city, there is rubble everywhere. It's going to take such a long time to clear it. The United Nations have got a work program to employ people, but it's going to take hundreds of thousands of people to be able to make any dent into the amount of rubble and construction reconstruction which needs to be done here.
Okay, thanks so much. Nick Davis is the BBC correspondent in Haiti. He joined us from Port-au-Prince.
Coming up, we'll be talking about some programs to help kids graduate early so they can go to college. But a lot of you have already had experience with this. Would you have been ready for work life or college life at age 16?
This is Mimi from Michigan, and I have a 16-year-old daughter who takes honors classes. She would be a wonderful candidate for entrance into early college. That's the only thing she doesn't really understand about high school is the hoopla about adolescent stuff.
This is Arik. I started college full-time when I was 16 and graduated when I was 18. I think early college programs are great. It was a good experience for me on the academic side. But the workforce wasn't ready for an 18-year-old with a bachelor's degree. I think maybe if this becomes more common, the situation could improve.
We want to hear your story at 8778MyTake or post to our site, thetakeaway.org, and we'll talk more about these programs in just a few minutes.
Coming up, what's the benefit in graduating high schoolers early so they can move on to community college at, say, 15 or 16? We're going to find out in just a few moments. But we're also taking your stories. Do you think early graduation is a good idea? And are 15-year-olds ready to go to college? Let us know at 8778MyTake. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A controversial visit to the White House this morning. That's the sound of children welcoming the Dalai Lama to Washington. The exiled Tibetan spiritual leader will meet with President Obama at the White House, despite strong protests from China. Also today, the president will sign an executive order to set up a bipartisan commission aimed at reining in the federal deficit. And our partner, the New York Times, is reporting the president is close to reaching a deal with Congress that would create an early warning system for the nation's financial industry.
We've been talking this morning about the potential health care premium spikes in several states across the country. Some insurance companies plan to raise their premium rates anywhere up to 60%. We checked in this morning with Robert Zirkelback, a spokesman for Washington's leading lobbying group for the health insurance industry, and he told us the price hike is justified.
But what's driving those increases are really two main factors. The first is that underlying medical costs are increasing rapidly, and that accounts for about half of the increase.
Earlier on today's show, John Brown, vice president of a furniture company in Oklahoma, told us this.
We're the victims here. We can't do anything but pay their premiums.
New economic numbers out in the last hour show that newly laid off workers filing for unemployment benefits rose by 31,000 last week. Analysts had expected a decline. The markets are open now. The Dow is down about 5 points. The S&P is down about 4. And the NASDAQ is down about 1 in early trading. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
School actually could be out sooner for some high school students in some states than we're used to. Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Kentucky. All of those states are planning to introduce a new program that will allow 10th graders to graduate early and go on to community college. And in Utah, they're considering a proposal right now that would eliminate the senior year altogether. What's going on in our school systems? We're going to ask our next guest that. He's Terry Holliday. He's the Kentucky's Education Commissioner, and he's currently trying to recruit 10 to 20 high schools in his state to start this program of allowing 10th graders to graduate early and go to college. Terry, are you having trouble recruiting students?
Oh, well, we're just beginning. We'll have a meeting in April to begin recruiting the districts, but we have a lot of districts that have expressed interest so far. I don't think we'll have a problem getting 10 to 20 high schools to implement this type of program.
I see that you've called this program the Move On When Ready program, and I have to be a little bit skeptical about that. Are 15-year-olds ready to move on to college?
Well, I've had an experience, came from North Carolina, where we had in place programs called Early College and Middle College, and certainly these students have been able to move on and get, gather college credits, but I think the key thing is making sure that all of our students are college ready. I think that's what this program focuses on first, making sure we put the standards out there and show the students how they should prepare to be college ready, because right now half the students in the nation that go on to college have to take remediation courses.
Well, is this about budget cuts? Are you trying to save money by sending kids out of school early?
No, in actuality, the long run, it may have some cost savings, but on the front end, it may have a little bit more cost. We're not trying to push kids out. We're trying to allow them early graduation types of options. We've had students that have had interests like this for years, but this would enable gifted students who are ready to move on to do so, and also enable students who oftentimes drop out because they're just bored with high school some choices. I think this is more about choice for parents and students than trying to push students somewhere they don't want to go.
Well, let's go to talk to a teacher now. Lauren Carbonell is a high school teacher at Quinebaug Valley Middle College High School in Danielson, Connecticut. Connecticut is one of the states that's also ready to implement this change in their high school system. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
You actually work in a school that's been allowing students to take community college courses for the past 2 years. But, you know, taking courses at a community college, which I did when I was in high school, is vastly different than going to college as a 15-year-old.
It is. I would say I think that there's a little bit more support as far as from parents, and our high school itself actually provides support for a lot of the students that do take community college classes.
So they're still in high school and taking community college courses. You heard us talking just a moment about people who are choosing students who are college ready, but the school examines whether they're intellectually or academically ready for college. And really, I would imagine the biggest problem is maturity level. You get to college and you're dealing with issues involved in sex. You're dealing with drinking issues. Often there's drug issues on a college campus. I can't imagine a 15 or 16-year-old is ready for that.
Well, I would say that in a community college versus like a boarding school, I would say that it's more likely for a student to get in trouble as far as like drinking and sex. In a boarding school, I know that when I started college at age 17, I probably spent the first year partying too much. But I think that in a community college, when you are commuting, there's less of that partying going on, and I think it enables kids to become more mature. So I would actually advocate that students who are going to community colleges at an early age are actually going to be positively influenced by some of the older students. As far as my classes that I teach, I actually teach after school at the community college as well, and I have students who are up to age 50, 55 or so. I think that actually they have a positive influence on some of my high school students that are taking the college class.
Terry Holliday, Kentucky's Education Commissioner, what is your response to that? Are students already having to deal with these issues of sex and drinking and possibly drugs in high school, so the maturity level is not as huge of an issue when they go to community college?
Absolutely, and I think what Lauren's talking about is what we'll be working through. The issues in this program is the wraparound services students need, so the transition is smooth and they have the support that they need. We're not talking about just throwing them on a boarding school campus. We're talking about open enrollment, community colleges, and creating conditions for their success through a partnership with the community colleges. This is happening all over the nation, and this program just allows us to make sure that we're getting the kids ready academically and to some degree emotionally for the challenges. But it'll be a choice program. No one would be forced into it.
You know, Terry, I can't help but have doubts when we see these issues with college students in their first 2 years getting in enormous numbers of credit card debt. That's not saying that a 15-year-old can get a credit card, but I'm just talking about levels of maturity and the trouble a kid can get into college when they start stepping out on their own. In Texas, they're looking at extending the school year because they feel that students aren't getting as much class time as they need to. I know that you say this is about choice and allowing people to go to college, but shouldn't we be taking a look at whether or not if kids are getting to college and still needing remedial classes, shouldn't they need more class time?
Well, we think that what this program will do will help the children be better prepared for college. And again, we have many examples of this type of program already all over the nation. Students end up with as many as 60 to 80 credit hours for college and save parents a lot of money and colleges a lot of money.
Terry Holliday is the Kentucky Education Commissioner. We also talked to Lauren Carbonell, a high school teacher at Quinebaug Valley Middle College High School in Danielson, Connecticut. Coming up... Pluto may not be a planet anymore, but it still deserves some love from the blue planet Earth. We're going to talk to astronaut Buzz Aldrin, also astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, about this on the 80th anniversary of Pluto's discovery. They're going to join us to talk about Pluto later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. We spoke earlier this morning with Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez about the prevalence of sexual assault in the U.S. military, and the Congresswoman is not satisfied with how accepted it is.
We have a policy, and we've had for several years now, that women must go in the buddy system to the restroom. Most women will not go to the restroom at night because that's when most of the attacks are happening, for example.
You can hear that full interview at thetakeaway.org. And, you know, that's about sexual assault in the military, but worldwide there are still questions about whether or not women should be serving in the front lines at all. Joining us now is Nuala McGovern. She's the host of the BBC's call-in show, World Have Your Say. And they're taking a global look at the issue of women serving in the military. Nuala, you had two women on your program with two very different perspectives. First, let's hear a little bit from Catherine Ross. She's a former soldier in the U.S. Army.
The reality on the ground does not match the policy. The reality is that we find ourselves serving with ground combat units at battalion level and below every day in Iraq. I mean, I'm not the only one who's done it. There are many other females who have done it. So, you know, there are women who are capable of serving in combat arms units, and they should be afforded that opportunity if they want it.
Did you hear from listeners who talked about women actually serving in frontline combat units?
Yes, we did indeed, Celeste. And I think it really was, you know, fairly split down the middle, their opinion. I brought in a couple of comments off a couple of people who agreed with Catherine. David in the UK, he wrote on the World Have Your Say blog that Russia used women extensively during World War II, and a lot of Britain's women went into occupied France as agents. And women are doing just fine in Iraq and Afghanistan. If they want to serve their country as combatants, I'll be the first to salute them. Sherry took a different point. Hers was, if women can deliver a 14-pound baby, then they can handle anything. I mean, one thing that was quite interesting about Catherine Ross, who was featured in the New York Times blog, The Opinionator, her husband is actually in active duty and he does not agree with it. He does not think women should serve on the front line.
He's a little biased, though. You also talked to Judy Webb. She's the first female officer to command an all-male squadron in the United Kingdom. Here's what she had to say.
I do not think that there is a role for women in the infantry. I just feel that our physical differences are such that very few women want to achieve those sort of physical levels. And I think to the detriment of the armed services generally, it reduces the standards of an infantry soldier's fitness. And I don't think that's acceptable.
Did you find that this is what things kind of hinged on, that women are not as physically capable of it as men?
Well, it was really interesting. That's where our conversation began. But that was really only just one part of it. Other arguments, which I found really interesting, one was the distraction factor. And really that moved from everything from men behaving differently when there's a woman around to taking maybe more risks if they were in the front line with a female colleague. And there was also the issue of troop morale. And apparently, according to some people, it really affects a platoon much more significantly when a female colleague is killed rather than a male colleague, which I thought were another three of the arguments.
Was it mostly women that were supporting the right to be in combat units?
Excuse me, Celeste?
Was it mostly women who said that women should be able to fight?
No, it was totally split down the middle. We had a number of people that agreed or disagreed. Lance emailed, he said, when the hand-to-hand combat begins and women are taken prisoners and sexually violated, what do we say then? Echo Rose in Florida says, if a woman can carry her weight, let her do it.
Okay, Nuala McGovern, host of the last night's BBC call-in show, World Have Your Say.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Celeste, I have a little bit of verse here for you. It's a planetary poem, if you're ready.
Really? You're going to read this poem?
I'm going to do it. I'm doing it.
Okay, go. Make it fast.
Pluto, Pluto, in the sky, you're not a planet, but we love you. Why?
Very nice. Why? Very nice.
Who else but Leo Duran, Takeaway producer, would have written that? Coming up, we're going to be talking about Pluto and the 80th anniversary of its discovery with astronaut Buzz Aldrin and astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. They're going to be joining us in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on some leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. We've been talking this morning about the potential healthcare premium spikes in several states across the country. Some insurance companies plan to raise their premium rates up to 60%. Now, a few minutes ago, we attributed a piece of sound to Robert Zirkelbach. He's a spokesman for the health insurance lobby in Washington. The sound was actually from Brad Flugel. He's executive vice president of WellPoint, the parent company of Blue Cross Blue Shield. Again, here's what he said.
But what's driving those increases are really two main factors. The first is that underlying medical costs are increasing rapidly, and that accounts for about half of the increase.
That was Brad Flugel, executive vice president of WellPoint, the parent company of Blue Cross Blue Shield.
And Americans are basking in the glow of six medals, including three golds earned in a single day at the Vancouver Olympics yesterday, the best day ever for the U.S. in the history of the Winter Games. President Obama is expected to seize on planned health care increases to increase his case for a health care overhaul. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
80 years ago, an astronomer named Clyde Tombaugh, who worked at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, made a discovery that would capture the imagination of space enthusiasts for generations, including this kid. Tombaugh discovered Pluto. In honor of that discovery, we have two guests who've had a hand in how we think and dream about space, and certainly about what some people call the dwarf planet. I'm joined by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist and author and host of Nova's Science Now. And get this, astronaut Buzz Aldrin, Apollo 11 moonwalker. It's an honor to have you both on the show.
Happy to be here.
Hey, good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Buzz. How the hell are you, man?
Professor Tyson, let me start with you about Pluto. Now, of course, we've had the long-running debate about whether Pluto is a planet or not. And to Pluto planet lovers, I got to say, you're one of the villains. You've referred to Pluto as a dwarf planet. You've referred to it noncommittally as a cosmic object. Where are we in our thinking about Pluto and its membership in the solar system?
Don't shoot the messenger.
Right.
All I did was reveal to the world with a group of my colleagues back in New York. In fact, it was almost exactly 10 years ago. We opened the new Rose Center for Earth and Space, the then new facility. And when you have a new facility, it gives you an occasion to rethink the trend lines in scientific discovery and how you might create an exhibit. So we put up an exhibit upon realizing that there's some other icy, small, weird orbited objects in the outer solar system. We decided to group Pluto among them. This is now known as the Kuiper Belt of icy objects. And that's really all we did. We didn't kick Pluto out of the solar system, but we were the first to do this publicly. And there had been a debate sort of percolating behind the scenes, and it finally hit a head in 2006 when the international community of astronomers voted to formally demote Pluto or reclassify it to dwarf planet status. And this pissed off a lot of people.
Sure. And to so many people, it was sort of kicking it out of the solar system because all of us had learned, of course, nine planets and Pluto is the smallest of them all. And it's kind of the darling. Have you discovered that? I know you have your new show, The Pluto Files, which is coming up next month. You're kind of touring the country talking about Pluto.
Yeah, so the book that I wrote, The Pluto Files, was really a catharsis for me because I was branded as public enemy for having revealed this information about Pluto. And so in the Pluto Files, it shares with the viewer, the reader in the case of the book, but the special coming up on March 2nd, actually, it's kids, third graders, sending me hate mail. So a lot of it is entertaining, and it's all in fun, but it revealed something about the power of this particular cosmic object in the hearts and minds of Americans.
You still can't say the P word, can you? You just can't say it. You can't say it. Buzz Aldrin, let me ask you if I could, you know, traveling to Pluto, the dream of that, far from it, the latest budget from the Obama administration, as I know you know, zeroes out the Constellation program. That is putting a major impediment on man's scheduled return to the moon on manned spaceflight. How do you view where we're at in terms of promoting manned spaceflight right now?
Well, Neil is a troublemaker about Pluto, and I grew up with Pluto, a Disney character, and wondering Pluto, the dog, was doing way out there. But I'm kind of a troublemaker right now because we need to do some things that interject a changeover from government launch humans into low Earth orbit to commercial launching. Of humans into, and that's a pet project of mine because we've been landing people for 30 years with the space shuttle, and it wasn't a mistake. It was a very big, technically complex vehicle, but to follow that by landing back in the ocean again is just not what we ought to be doing. Yeah, that's why I've been behind a lifting body runway lander as soon as we can get it done on a very reliable Atlas V launch vehicle.
On an Atlas V rocket?
And at the same time do all we can to close the gap so that we don't have to buy rides to our space station from the Russians.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, either way, manned spaceflight is going to be slowed down with the budget cuts that we've had, whether it's to the moon or beyond, and whether it's on an Atlas rocket or a Constellation launch vehicle.
I've never been strongly opinionated about one species of launch vehicle or another.
Right.
I know Buzz has been. But what Buzz has gotten right from the very beginning is the fact that you don't have a sustained presence in space unless a space program morphs into a space industry. And without the commercial support for what we all hope to be a sustained presence in space, then NASA has to, you know, go hat in hand to Congress every year. And so one of the sort of silver linings of this, of these new decisions regarding NASA in the Obama administration is the tacit statement that they want NASA to sort of get out of the low Earth orbit business and cede that over to commercial enterprise. And that's a very natural trajectory that the government has taken in the past. The government historically has made the initial investments in industries or activities that for which the capital markets couldn't value until it was established, and then the capital markets swoop in, and it creates thriving tax base for the country.
And in the meantime, Neil deGrasse Tyson, before we sort out how to get high Earth orbit manned launch either to the moon or beyond, we're going to have to be satisfied probably with what we have, which is Hubble photos. I've been pretty impressed. Well, I'm a huge fan of Hubble deep field photos, but we've got some new photos of, well, I'm going to call it a planet. You can call it what you want, but we've got some new Hubble photos of Pluto.
Yeah, so Hubble, you know, Hubble is a great substitute for going there. you zoom in and see what you've got. And the latest images from Pluto, normally we associate Hubble with deep field objects across the universe, but it can look at relatively nearby objects as well. And these recent objects, images of Pluto, show that the surface is actually quite interesting, highly varied in reflectivity, and even some sort of amber color that's there. It's a little bit mysterious. But there's a mission headed there right now, the New Horizons mission, in the fast lane. It'll get there in about 5 years, and it'll get the first very close-up images of Pluto from a flyby. But images of distant objects versus traveling there, these are two different kinds of enterprises. And, you know, Buzz is a hero because he went to a new cosmic object. And as a culture, we value our explorers in ways that few other people in society are valued. We build statues to explorers. We write books and stories and novels about them. And so to remove that as sort of the dream that so many of us maybe even took for granted growing up in the 60s and early 70s, I think it undersells who and what we can be as a nation.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and author and host of Nova Science Now. And Buzz Aldrin, of course, retired astronaut and moonwalker, joined us to give us their vision of the future of space. Thank you both. And I think Two Skinny Jays has something to say about this Pluto debate.
If Pluto is still a planet for you, you can get us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or the takeaway.org. You can also go to our website to get our podcast. Earlier in the program, we talked about programs to help kids graduate early so they can go to college at maybe 15 or 16. We've been hearing your stories about it.
This is Eric calling from South Florida. I almost dropped out of high school in ninth grade because I wanted to get into college so badly. Luckily, in South Florida, they have this thing called the School for Advanced Studies that allows you to start college as part of dual enrollment half-time in 11th grade. and graduate with enough credits to have an associate's degree and then go on to regular college. So, yeah, I think it should be definitely an option nationwide.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.